What? This girl from my past, that ridiculous ass. She attended UMass and she passed every class. Walked down the hall with a stuck up sass. Broke the basketball plate.
Oh, see, it's time to pay dues, deliver the news. Like UMass, we refuse to lose.
Yeah. I like a really huge ass.
Bend over, take it to church, let's see a UMass.
I think I'd rather die in a nuclear war than go to OAN.
Okay, good evening. This is Korea Sage, 8 p.m. Sunday, here in New York City, 6 hours removed from that difficult UMass loss with my kids, both screaming in the background, not really going to bed, so I may have to interrupt this programming to tend to that, but let's get right in. I don't want to call this an emergency podcast, because it's not. Usually an emergency pod on this program connotes a sounding of the alarm, if you will. I'm sounding an alarm, but I'm not calling it an emergency pod because it was, after all, if you put it in context, only the first loss of the season. And usually there's got to be a disastrous loss after, you know, followed by or preceded by, I should say, some other losses, and you get to that point where you're just like, this ain't working. I'm not ready to say that yet, but the reason it's a quasi-emergency pod, where we're teetering on the edge of emergency status, is because this is year four for Matt McCall. And so let's back up for a second. First of all, the program, of course, is brought to you, as always, by the fine folks at Five College Movers. Stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. Wherever you go, go with Five College. Friends of the program, friends of the podcast, friends of UMass basketball. Call Pat and the gang and tell them we sent you. Hang on, my kids are going nuts. All right, tended to the little ones. The one-year-old had just taken a massive shit, so that woke him up, and then that woke up the four-and-a-half-year-old. So, anyway. I don't know exactly where I was, but thanks to the fine folks at Five College Movers, as always. So let's do a little context for where we are in terms of like why this episode is taking place and why there is a certain level of urgency around it. Firstly, we had a 278-day break between UMass basketball games. So when you're the UMass basketball podcast, you can pump out only so much content before it becomes niche UMass Twitter memes and shit posting and just the inanities of everyday online life, right? At a certain point, it's like, let's talk about the meat of the subject matter here, which is a very promising UMass basketball team. And when they opened their season on Friday, abruptly, by the way, again, like, that's part of this year, there was just abrupt scheduling. Oh, we're going to play now Northeastern twice. I was concerned right off the bat because I knew Bill Cohn could coach, and I don't care how good this UMass group is. It's not easy to play back-to-backs against a really well-coached team, even from a lower conference. They were in the tournament, but last year there wasn't a tournament. The year prior, they were a 13 seed. You know, they have a good program there. Yes, they're young. Yes, UMass should have won. I don't want to overlook that, but they are a good program. Be that as it may, this is what we're here for. We're here to break down this basketball team, and especially in this year when we don't know how many games we're going to get. Every game, and by the way, and especially after the season was delayed and every other team had played 3, 4, 5 games and UMass hadn't played any, especially after that, each game is going to take on a significance of, you know, an exaggerated significance compared to a regular season. There may only be 23, 24 games, right? And there may only be 3 or 4 non-conference games. And so, at least for me, the sports world is not very compelling right now, so this is like the first time I've been locked in on games, really since the end of last season. I got into the NBA playoffs a bit, but watched a little bit of college football, very little. This matters, right? It matters. This is what we're here for. I mean, whatever you can dispute the significance of fandom and all that, we do that all the time, but we're here now, right? So let's just set the stage. They go out Friday, they play great. Actually, they didn't even play great. What was amazing was they hung 94 points, and there was still room for improvement. Javon Garcia lived up to not only lived up to expectations, exceeded them. Trey Mitchell, back with a vengeance, played phenomenally. You know,
31 points and it barely felt like it was trying. It was, everything was rolling, right? I mean, you just felt good. So they, 2 days later, they go back to Northeastern. And if I'm not mistaken, by the way, I've heard from sources that they traveled this morning. Because of the nature of COVID, they didn't even stay over last night. So that, not to make excuses, but not an ideal circumstance to go on, you know, on a two-hour bus ride for a noon game when you're college kids, right? They get there. The first half is pretty much back and forth. Even, you know, they make some mistakes. Northeastern makes some mistakes. Northeastern got a bit of a home whistle, as UMass did on Friday, by the way. Trey picks up a couple fouls. You know, they miss some shots. They're playing ridiculously fast. You know, you don't really know where the game is going. It's clear that it could be a close game. Northeastern does that thing in the second half that so often happens to McCall teams, where a lead goes from like 3 to 11 in what feels like 4 seconds. In this case, it went, you know, it probably was a couple minutes, but it just eroded very quickly. Trey went out of the game with a foul. Gasparini jacked that 3, which would have tied it, and then they went down, hit another shot, 6, 8. It's like all of a sudden, you know, and when you have a guy like Bill Cohn, once he gets that 11-point lead, he really slowed the tempo, and it was almost like UMass was then playing into that. There was one point at the 6-minute mark where we took 27 seconds to get a shot off, and you're like, guys, you're down like 11, 12 points. Lo and behold, they frantically storm back. Miraculously, everyone on Twitter had like completely given up. They're like, this game is over. I actually hadn't, because I knew they'd make some sort of run. I did not think they'd make as much of a run as they did. And I believe then Northeastern missed their final 2 free throws, right? So UMass gets the ball. They come down. Carl Pierre, I don't know what he's doing. I don't know how to make nice about this. He just drives the lane for an attempted dunk or runner. I don't know what was going on. He misses it. They lose the game by 3. Okay, so we can get into the final play later. The fact that they even had a chance to tie on that possession was, like, shocking. I mean, they probably rattled off 8 of those points to cut the lead from, you know, at one point 14, but they rattled off like 7 or 8 points in what felt like, you know, 35 seconds. It was like borderline Reggie Miller versus the Knicks in the mid-90s type stuff. And it was very impressive, actually. And, you know, Javon Garcia, Noah Fernandez, and TJ Weeks are all really good guards who were leading the attack there. Trey had a bucket or two in that stretch. I feel like played really poorly otherwise. UMass loses a game. Everybody on Twitter is losing their shit. And I rate it McCall, and I rate it Carl, and some frustration toward Trey. And all of these things are justified. And any time you lose a game to an inferior opponent, that's going to happen. And everyone is justified, including, you know, me, for feeling that way. We're all frustrated. The challenge here is that, out of context, this loss, as I said on Twitter, you know, if you bring in a neutral observer and you have them watch these two teams, you say, yeah, UMass probably wins 3 out of 4 against that group, and at least 2 of those games are fairly close. Today was the day they lost. UMass on the road is not so much better than that Northeastern team at the start of a season, right? They're better. Neutral court, I still think UMass is 8, 9 points better, 10 even. But Cohn coaches in a methodical way with a really good point guard, such that you're not going to completely blow them out of the water. Even the other day, it was kind of surprising that it got to 15. And even in that game, Northeastern shot pretty well. So what is the point of all this? The point of all this is to say that if this was a December 13th game, as it was today, and we were 5-0, and we'd beaten a, you know, 5-6-0, and we'd beaten a bunch of, you know, cupcake teams, and maybe had a respectable win over, or even a close loss at home to Rutgers, or whatever was going to happen in that normal schedule, and things had gone more or less according to plan for a team this good, and then they went on the road and played Northeastern 6, 7, 8 games into the year, and Northeastern had evolved, and they were pretty decent, and it was at their gym, and they got a couple calls, as they did today, by the way, and UMass got some at home, by the way, I should note. So if you lose that game in under those circumstances, I think people could stomach it, right? It's like, okay, you know, it's still a young UMass team. It's a respectable opponent on the road with a good coach. They were prepared. You know, it's a big game for them, whatever. You lose one, you get back on board. You know, you get back to the next one, you rattle a couple more wins off, and you finish non-conference 10-3, 11-2, something like that. You enter a conference play with some optimism. Those games happen, whether it's against Harvard and when they're good or – you know, I mean, it's again, it's not ideal, but I want to. It's not in the camp of losing to a bad Holy Cross team, right? Or I mean, I think the CAA is considerably above the Patriot League for the most part. Northeastern is regularly in the tournament. They're young this year, but they've got a really good point guard. They got some length, some strength. They're not horrible, right? It's a team you should beat, to be clear. But you know, on the road, whatever, shit happens. It's not, you know, Howard at home. I mean, there's been way more catastrophic losses in the McCall tenure. I mean, way more. And it's, you know, it's probably a little bit like Akron if it was this team instead of last year's team losing at Akron as they did last year. But, like, I think this year's team would be better than Akron. You know, so it's, again, it's a lower conference team but not a terrible conference team, well-coached, you know, whatever. However, that is not the set of circumstances we have this year. And we cannot use the set of circumstances we have as an excuse because Northeastern has been under the precisely same set of circumstances. So what are the circumstances? Well, the circumstances are that you might only have three or four non-conference games. You play your first conference game 4 days from now in Philly. 4 days? 3 days. 3 days from now in Philly. I think they play Wednesday. Yeah. And the season is here. It's whatever the COVID dynamics have been, they are what they are, and we know that the roster has the talent to be good because we watched them on Friday, and they were rusty and still hung 94 on a respectable team. So it's almost like that was probably a bad omen because they started out, you know, flashing a lot of what we knew they were capable of so quickly that it was like, well, I guess we can't call them, like, rusty, you know. And let's go zoom out a little bit, bigger picture here. The other contextual circumstance surrounding this basketball team is that this is year four for Matt McCall. It's a make-or-break year in many regards. And he has a good roster. The talent is there. And by the way, it is a young roster. But the funny thing is, A, you can't use that as an excuse because it's your fourth year. So if you hypothetically were building toward year four, you have a bunch of seniors now because you get a bunch of kids your first year. So you can't use that. And B, the best players on the team are freshmen and sophomores and beat the same opponent by 15 days ago. So you know you are capable of playing better than you did today. And we've seen a lot of these, you know, we've seen far worse than this before. But the reality is, you don't have time now. There has to be a sense of desperation for you as a coach. And so while this wasn't by any stretch of the imagination the worst game Matt McCall has ever coached, and it wasn't the worst team he's ever lost to or the worst game, even close to one of the worst games his team has ever played, it is a frustrating loss to a team you're better than in a year in which opportunities to play games, period, are scarce, and in a year in which you need to win all of those borderline games because you're in your fourth year and the gig is up. The jig is up. Is it jig or gig? I mean, gig, you lose your job, but the tricks are, there's no more room for error. And that's just the nature of what you're, of the profession you're operating in, and the sort of magnifying glass you're under. Is it fair? Probably not in some objective sense. You know, I suspect the analytics types would just look at every game and say, well, you know, if you had a 62% chance of winning today, it's not so bad that you lost to a 38, you know, and you get back to the next one and you beat a team you're supposed, you know, whatever. But in the end, it's like, well, you only get so many shots because you had 3 years of that, okay? And now it's make or break. So today sucked. That is all to say that today sucked. And there are no excuses for a loss like that. It's also to say that let's pump the brakes a little bit intellectually. Like, fanatically, fandom-wise, we should all be irate and losing our shit, because that's what fans do, and that's totally reasonable. And we've seen this before, and we don't want to see it again, and we're sick and tired of it. However, we didn't play very well until the last couple minutes. And if you think about years in which we played anyone other than the worst of the worst teams and didn't play well, under McCall, we got blown out of the fucking gym. I mean, Harvard last year lost by 40, and they weren't that good. You know, there's so many instances in which we didn't play that well and, you know, just got clobbered. Now, this game is a little bit more like some of those home losses last year. South Carolina, Yale come to mind. But it's also worth noting that, you know, it is a young group. It's the first time they've gone on the road. And even though Matt can't win on the road, and that's very concerning, it's the first one. Now, if they lose Wednesday at a not very good LaSalle team on the road, and they lose in similar fashion, then it gets to that point where it's real existential dread, where you just say, you know what? This guy doesn't know how to win ugly games against marginal but not terrible opponents. And that's a major skill, a major criteria of good coaching, right? You beat the teams you're supposed to beat, and occasionally you steal one against a good team, but you gotta win 8 out of 10 or whatever it is against marginal teams when it gets a little ugly. Like, that's the test of a good team versus an average team. Last year was an average team, and they, as they got better, they learned to win a couple of those, mostly at home, but they got a couple, like Fordham and LaSalle on the road last year. Those are the kind of wins I'm talking about. And today is a game in that camp. So there was hope that you were sort of over that, can't win on the road against a marginal team. They did not get over that hump today. But let's also step back for a moment and think a little bit optimistically, or look a little bit optimistically about what the good things that came to be on Friday and the unique circumstances that surrounded today's loss. It is in college basketball, the role of the coach, the blame always falls on the coach. And because McCall's had so many frustrating losses before, the temptation is to immediately go after him. And he deserves it for the way he handled that last possession, for the way he handled subbing for long stretches of this one, and particularly with playing Carl Pierre over TJ Weeks. You know, that was egregious. But relatively speaking, this was not anywhere near one of his worst coach performances. Not even close. It wasn't a badly coached game. It wasn't a well-coached game. But, you know, I've seen far worse around the country and at UMass over the years, right? I mean, this was, you know, there were mistakes. It's game two. Bill Cohn's a really good coach. He outcoached him. But it wasn't like he was running circles around him, okay? Let's be clear here. Trey had the worst game of his career. I mean, that's just, he looked frustrated. At one point, he looked a little pouty, which was really shocking. Some of it was justified because he was getting bodied hard, and it's frustrating. He wasn't always getting touches. You know, when he was getting touches, he was forcing things a little bit. He picked up a couple frustrating fouls that were kind of 50-50, but, you know, you can't really pick them up. There was that one where he's a little out of control on a play. I don't know if it was called offensive, but it was like, there was maybe a loose ball, and he sort of ran a guy over. I forget exactly how it played out, but, you know, there was that. So when the best player in the league doesn't come through, I mean, you know, it's going to be difficult. The other thing is the bench sucked. Some of that's on McCall because I don't think he gave them the space and time to get settled. Dabaji Walker missed two shots, never played again, 3 minutes. I'm not saying Dabaji's as good as I've said he is in the past, because I know that people take issue with that, but you can't tell me that Carl Pierre should get 29 minutes and go 2-for-7, and Dabaji should get 3 minutes and go 0-for-2. Neither of them is a transcendent talent right now in this group. There's better players, but one of them will, you know, or two of them combined will provide what you need in terms of a sixth option, right? I mean, that's what you're looking for. And if one guy's not doing it, let the other guy have a shot. Debaji, and neither DeCarlo nor Debaji are particularly good at right now as half-court defenders, but you can't tell me that they're 26 minutes apart in quality. And I know Debaji was apparently coming off a cold or whatever. He did not play on Friday. That was bad decision-making. You got to give a kid a little time to get in the flow, especially because when he did come in, they were playing like 180 possessions a second, and you know, it was a little too fast for guys first coming into the game. Let him get in the flow. You know, let him try to, you know, go off the dribble one or two times, whatever. DeAndre Dominguez, Mark Gasparini, other guys off the bench struggled. But again, they didn't get many minutes. You know, there's a pretty clear-cut rotation. So there were issues there. I don't even know how I got onto the bench as a matter of discussion. Going back to the big picture here, this was not entirely a coach's loss. Players, you know, these kids got to want it too. And they played fine. There were some real bright spots. The point guard upgrade was spectacular. I mean, Garcia and Fernandez combined to go, I think, 12 for 22. They hit a bunch of threes between them. They were both really good. I mean, we're clearly better at the one. And frankly, if you'd said over the weekend that those guys would put up those numbers, there's no chance we lose this game. But, you know, Carl and Trey struggled and the bench didn't come through, and not having Preston probably hurt. Would have liked to see Kyra McCrory get some minutes today too, especially because I think he's a good defender. Colton Mitchell, interesting dynamic there because he's so good defensively and helps you in a lot of ways defensively, but you're kind of playing 4v5 on offense to an extent. Not that he's like incapable of playing offense, but you can't really make a justification that when these other two guys are shooting 6 for 11 and getting to the cup at will, frankly, Garcia like could have easily been like 9 for 11 if he'd gotten some calls. He should have got to the line. Or I guess you'd say he'd be like 6 for 9 or something and then hit more free throws, because he got hacked a few times and didn't get the call and still finished, I think, 6 for 11. So you can't really justify Colton out there when those two are playing that well. The abominable decision today was just the lack of minutes for TJ Weeks. He's a fucking scorer. He also was our second leading rebounder. He gets to the cup at will, and you can actually manage, even if Trey's struggling, because you have him and the two point guards. Get out and go. Score. Tempo is a discussion we could have at length. I think they were a little undecided about what they wanted to do today. They were playing so fast the first 12 minutes of that game. It was like unbelievable. I was disoriented. And then they let Northeastern play so slow toward the end. The truth is they should have played fast, but not as fast. And when they did, when they started doing that late, when they really were, you know, making that comeback, that was the tempo, you know, you want to see for the rest of the game. I don't really know where I'm going here with this rant. I got a lot of thoughts out. My point is, as painful as it is to say, we got to pump the brakes until at least Wednesday, right? It's a home and home against respectable team. We should have won given the quality of talent we saw that this team has. Ronnie DeGray's emergence, outstanding. Clear-cut, four-year starter, glue guy. All the hype I had about these kids has lived up to the billing. So that is why there's frustration with McCall right now, because Ronnie DeGray, Jovan Garcia, Noah Fernandez, TJ Weeks are all really good. And obviously, Trey, you have a clear-cut starting five. If that's not the starting five on Wednesday, I mean, let's just fucking, I'm going to blow a gasket, because those are your five best players. It is so clear right now. It's going to take some time maybe for the bench to emerge, but you know there's talent there. And the way they want to play, where they play up-tempo, I think you're going to have to find guys more minutes. You got to cut Carl's minutes, you know, from 29 or 32 or whatever to 20 right now, right? Like it's hard because I love Carl. He's done so much for the program. He's been match guy from the first time he got there. But the reality is, athletically, with what they want to do and what they're now capable of doing in terms of JG pushing tempo and finding guys, Carl really needs to return to being a catch-and-shoot guy like he was his freshman year if he wants to, you know, be a meaningful contributor on this roster. He had a couple nice takes today, but I don't understand why he's putting the ball on the floor. It just it fucks with the flow of the offense. Catch it, shoot it, go. I mean, if you're putting it on the floor, you're not like a super explosive dude, and you have JG and TJ who can get to the cup at will, as can Fernandez to a certain extent, and you have Trey down low. So Carl's got to be in the corner just pick and pop, you know, just hitting shots, right? And if he's not, then you got to go with somebody else off the bench, because that role can be fulfilled by Dabaji. It can be fulfilled by DeAndre Dominguez. You know, somebody will right? Like, there should be a rotating cast of Dabaji, DeAndre, and Carl, and maybe even McCrorial. He's not known for his three-point shooting, but of those three, as basically like the second three-point shooter next to TJ, you know, if they're on the court with him, or if they're on the court solo, just the shooter guy. They don't have to do much else right now. You know what I mean? Like, pump fake, go to the rim, whatever, but get in the flow. Find one of those guys who will get hot, and then you go with the five I just mentioned, plus one of those guys, and hopefully Gasparini will provide a better spell for Trey. He hasn't been great in the first two, but you know, he knows where to be. He'll figure it out. I'm actually not terribly worried about him, despite some challenges at the in the first couple games. I think he, even that three he took today, I didn't hate it. He moves fairly well. You know, he's been a little lost, but I'm not really concerned about him. And Colton will give you solid defensive minutes when necessary. But you don't need Carl playing 32 minutes and going. I mean, he went 5 for 15 in game one, I think, 2 for 7 today. So that's 7 for 22 on the year, right? That's a Sean East game, you know? And it's like, to me, that's a lot of shots when you have JG, who was 9 for 13 and 6 for 11 in the two games, and you have Fernandez, you know, who shot a high percentage today, and you have TJ Weeks, who shot a high percentage today. You've got other guys who can do that. And I'm not saying bench Carl and this and that. No, like, he has a role to play here. And if he gets hot, we know, you know, he single-handedly beat Providence as a sophomore. I haven't forgotten that. So sit in the corner, stroke a three. You know, if you really can get to the rim on a guy, fine. But, like, that low percentage or low analytically yielding, I should say, you know, 12-footer mid-range thing, it's like, when you think about the other shots you can get on this team, for both yourself, right, shoot a three, Carl, and the rest of the team, dump it off to literally the best big man in the league, and, you know, or let JG and Noah just go to the rim, right? I mean, there's a lot of better ways for this team to score, okay? And yeah, he hit a couple today late that were, like, kind of difficult shots, but it's still like, okay, but JG and Noah were getting to the rim with ease. We haven't had, I mean, Sean East could do that to an extent last year, but not like JG. Let's talk about JG for a little. Let's segue. He's fucking good, man. He's everybody I've talked to is like, including the haters, you know, offline, are like, well, you have, somebody I talked to today, I said, you have a player of the year and a rookie of the year on the same team and a couple other guys who can play a little bit. Don't overcomplicate it. And that's pretty much it, you know? And, you know, I wish I had McCall in the set one more time to break down his offense, because I know he's doing shit, and I just think he's doing too much. There's a lot of plays. You can tell there's a lot of sets, and guys are like kind of like, you know more or less where to be, but it's like, with this group, you got to just have, like, one screen to get Trey or TJ open, and if the play breaks down, just go. They're improvisationally capable of scoring once a play breaks down, and I feel like what will happen is, like, a good team like Northeastern will, sometimes they won't, right? So I was going to say a good team like Northeastern will read the play,
deny the cut or whatever, and then UMass will start and try to run another set, and they'll get down to 3 seconds on the shot clock. What I'm saying is, like, when the first option breaks down, just go. And I can't totally figure out what it is they're doing. There's a little bit of pick and roll. You know, there's some pick and pop. There's a little bit of dribble handoff stuff. I need someone with more technical savvy than I have to break some of it down. But the reality is, and they're doing a better job of getting Trey open and getting him the ball. So I'll give them that, especially on Friday. But the reality is, JG can get to the cup without a set play, you know, and Trey can roll right off it and get a, you know, two-footer. Like, we have guys who can make plays. And I think in year one, you know, Pipkins had that to an extent. And so Pipkins would just have the ball the whole game. He would do what he had to do. And then Carl would, you know, catch and shoot. And it kind of worked because it almost forced them to oversimplify the offense. I think in years two and particularly three at times, particularly the first half, Matt tried to go back to running a lot of screens and working the shot clock. And I think it worked at times, but it didn't distinguish always who was getting the ball, right? And now it's like, yeah, so we've got a clear cut first three and a half options. It's like, dump it down to Trey, so find a way to get him open. If he can't get open, JG, go take your man to the rim, draw a defender, dump it off to Trey or kick it out to TJ or Noah for a three. And by the way, Ronnie DeGray is a beast. He gets boards. They did, and I'll give him credit. They ran a couple set plays for Ronnie, and those really worked well. There was a few easy buckets for him today. But overall, all those actions weren't working. We had 8 team assists today. 8 on 75 points. So that's not an indication that your half-court flow is seamless and that the guys totally have internalized your offense, like, you know, in the same way you see at a Davidson or a Bonaventure or Richmond, where it's just, like, seamless and effortless and you don't even know what they're running because they're just running circles around you, but you know that they've practiced that so methodically in practice that it's that good. UMass doesn't need to be that team. Right? Like, their identity, I think, is probably better when they were, like, getting up and down. Yes, it leads to some easy buckets for Northeastern, and yes, it, you know, they looked a little gassed at times today. But overall, I think that track meet pace they had going most of the first half eventually probably would have, you know, broken through and led to enough turnovers and stops that UMass would have had so many more possessions that I just think it would have been a numbers game and they probably would have won. I think they outshot Northeastern 68-51 in game one, something like that. I was talking to a buddy who's like I've told you guys about him on the show before, an analytics freak, professional gambler, like legit worked at a very elite, you know, consulting firm before moving to Vegas, the real deal. Some of you may have met him with me at the Vegas tournament 5 years ago, but he doesn't know anything about UMass. And I called him. I was like, why is UMass only a two-point favorite after winning by 15? He was like, oh, that's what I would have thought. He's like, it was 6 yesterday. He's like, they're not going to adjust much. He's like, it's probably going to be 2 or 3. And he was right. I mean, he said he looked at the box score and he's like, oh, wow, the difference in that game was they must have been just tempo, 68-51 in shot attempts. You saw it right away, you know, and like, I don't know what it was today. Let me pull up my box score, but it sure shit wasn't that. So that's my thoughts on the games. I'm not going to go existential yet just because what good does it do, right? I mean, here's the thing. This season is going to be quick, and it's going to be unpredictable, and it's going to be weird, and you have to look at the totality of the circumstances at the end because you just know, like, if they don't win enough games, if they go 500 or if they go below 500, they go one game over, then we're going to have really serious conversations about where the future of this program is. And, you know, there's a part of me that is already ready to have those, but there's also a part of me that says there's some really good dudes on this roster and it's game two. And I know, oh, Sage, we say this every year. But we also realize that the season is a season. You know, like last year we were all completely over it by January 20th or so. Then from January 26th, or I'm making it up, but to February 26th, they played the best basketball they have in years. So I'm not saying that this wasn't wildly disappointing, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't be alarmed because we've seen iterations of this before. But if you put it in context, this was nowhere near as bad as much of the disastrous stuff we've seen over the last 3 years. Now, obviously, much less margin for error. So, understandably, the frustration level is going to be, commensurate with the expectations. And it should be, and we should have high expectations. I just don't know what what it does to, beat a dead horse, if you will. I mean, I think we'll know when the wheels are off, and the wheels are not off yet, right? I mean, it's like, in a certain sense, I hope the kids aren't looking at what we're saying, because Javon Garcia, Noah Fernandez, Ronnie DeGray, three of the best contributors this weekend, they've never played a game for UMass. TJ Weeks has played, before this weekend, 10. So four of your best five had played prior to this weekend, cumulatively, 10 basketball games. Again, you could say, well, why does a fourth-year coach have four of his five best players who've only played a cumulative total of 10 basketball games in his fourth year? That's a legitimate question. That is. But the reality is they haven't. And that doesn't mean there's time to lose a bunch more of these. But, you know, it also is worth noting that they were really good. The new guys were really good. And so there's a lot to look forward to with this group. And I think it's important to remember that. This is a way better basketball team than last year. Last year's team doesn't even come close in this comeback. They lose to this Northeastern team today at this point in the season. 72-58. And let's also acknowledge that Trey played like shit today. Now, I am a little concerned that with all those other guys playing well, one bad Trey performance still led to defeat. You should have enough there to beat a Northeastern when most guys play well. Because most guys played well, other than Trey and Carl. You can't really blame the bench. They barely played. But then again, you could also be like, well, your senior captain and your preseason first teamer both played poorly and you only lost by 3. There is something to be said for that. So let's try to pump the brakes a little. I'm never going to tell people how to feel. They're totally right to be frustrated. I am too. I just think that, and we're frustrated. I'm frustrated at least because we've seen it before. But, you know, you do have to look a little analytically and be like, well, it's one game in one season. And let's see what they do on Wednesday. I hope they blow the fucking doors off LaSalle, because LaSalle struggled out of the gate. And just for my, like, psychic sanity about the future of this program, if you can't get a road win when there's not actually any fans there, not that there ever really were fans at LaSalle, but LaSalle is just like today's game in that it's a game that a good team should win. It's a 50-50 game for an average team like last year's group. So when we beat them last year, it was encouraging and it felt good to go on the road and get a win. And it will if they do it Wednesday. But make no mistake, they should win the basketball game Wednesday. They may have to win ugly, but if I see, you know, a 6-point deficit with 13 minutes to go and Pierre still on the floor over TJ when he's shooting, you know, 1-for-6, and, you know, DeBaggi still having played 2 minutes when, Carl is really struggling, I will lose my shit, because that's unacceptable. The things that Matt can control are
how he subs guys, that feel for the game stuff, right? You know, you can get philosophical about should we play fast, should we play slow. Like, that stuff is, you know, you can hash that out however you want. The sub stuff, to me, is a little more cut and dry. TJ's been fucking great. Or he was today. He played 18 minutes. So that's just a no-brainer. And Matt acknowledged it at the end of the game today, you know, in the post-game show or post-game presser or whatever. But, you know, Matt, like, that's your job. That's your job, right? And, you know, Trey probably won't struggle like that again. JG's going to have an off night. He's a freshman. But you just got to make the right subs. And that to me is like, I'm only going to lose my shit over that sort of stuff. Guys are going to have bad games. That's just like a reality of it. And so, you know, to some level today, like, I don't totally put it on him. I mean, I think the defensive rotations really need to improve. There were a number of open threes Northeastern missed. They were 7, I think they were like 7 for 21. Could have easily been, you know, 12 for whatever, and that's a different basketball game. And I thought the offense, you know, wasn't as crisp, you know, in the half court. There's things you need to work on, but those things, you know, that happens to any team, especially fairly young ones. What can't happen is just guys getting minutes that they shouldn't get. And I love what Carl Pierre has done for the university, but if he's not playing well, you got to take him out. And you couldn't do that last year. You didn't have people to replace him. You now have three better shooting guards on the team, right? So if he's not shooting well, you got plenty of options. And, you know, Dominguez is going to keep shooting. He'll figure it out. Let him shoot a little bit of those. You know, like, I'd rather have Dominguez go, he's got a decent looking stroke. Like, I'd rather have Dominguez go 1 for 5 than Carl go 2 for 9, right? Like, let other guys get some of those shots. And if Carl hits his first two, great. Play him 40 minutes. I don't give a shit. If he's sitting in the corner like he had against Maine a few years ago where he just hit like 8 in a row, it's gorgeous. I'll sit there and watch that all day. It's the prettiest stroke on the planet. But if he's not, he doesn't need to be in for 35 minutes. It's not hard. It's not hard. Especially because on this group, after the four I mentioned, and yeah, probably the four I mentioned in Trey, Ronnie, and Ronnie in part because of the uniqueness he brings from just a body and versatility perspective, but Ronnie and Trey, and I think JG, obviously JG, and Noah I think is emerging as that fourth. After that, and TJ, excuse me. So after that, the rest of the group, and Noah will be with that group some nights, Ronnie will be with that group some nights, basically other than the three, right, you have like six dudes at a minimum who basically like kind of are interchangeable. And losing Preston hurts because I think Preston was a clear, like in this context, you would have seen him as a clear-cut sixth or seventh man. Like if you put Carl as the sixth man, you know, Preston is a clear seventh right now with this group. But again, Preston, Carl, DeBaggi, to some extent, Dominguez, hopefully McCrory, Colton, they're interchangeable pieces to a certain extent. Yes, they do different things. They have different strengths. They're of different size. But, you know, like, if you want to go offensively oriented, play DeBaggi for a longer stretch and acknowledge that you might give up some points the other end because he's not as good of a defender. You want to lock teams down and play a little slower, put Colton in, and he won't make mistakes, but he probably isn't going to get many buckets, and he'll defend his dick off. So, like, you know, mix and match by all means. But let's not pretend like among that kind of really 4 through 11, but certainly 6 through 11, like there's this – or I should say 5 through 11, that there's this huge chasm where, you know, Carl gets 29 minutes and, you know, everybody else gets 5, right? It's just he's a senior. He's done some things here, but it's a different team now. And it's hard because I don't want to knock Carl, but it's like You can't watch that game and tell me he should be getting 30 minutes when and DeBaggio should get 3. You can 100% make the case he should get 22 and DeBaggio should get 10 or 11. That's a legitimate argument, right? But, you know, it's like, what's he giving you that these other guys can't? And again, I'm only picking on him because he's the one who's gotten disproportionate minutes. If Noah goes out one night and is, you know, 2 for 11 and, you know, not defending well, then Noah should go out. It's not, you know, the only guys in this group right now, I think that it's pretty clear JG has emerged. And he'll have off nights, but he's emerged as a secondary guy. He's a dude, right? Like he and Trey Mitchell are dudes. And in the A-10, I was saying this to some folks the other day, but I think in the A-10, the great teams have 3 dudes or even 4, like dudes. And then they have really good players up to like 6 or 7, like really solid guys. Right now, UMass has 2 dudes. Last year, they had 1 dude. Some years, they have like a half a dude. And then I think TJ is close to being a 3rd dude. He's certainly a really good player. And then Ronnie and Fernandez are clear good players, right? So, like, if you've got 5, you know, can you get to 6 or 7? Well, you can if Carl is used effectively. Because if Carl's just a good A-10 player who hits open shots and he plays efficiently and he gets his 11 or 12 points a night, that's a good rotation guy. So now you're at 6. And then all you need is one other guy, Preston, to come back or, you know, one of the freshmen who, you know, to figure it out. And you're there, right? Now you're in that domain where you need to be to talk about a double bye and all that. But when you're at 2 dudes and you're not playing your 3rd best player more than 18 minutes, and you're playing, you know, your 5th or 6th rotation guy 30, now it's like, well, you're good. You guys got some talent, but you're not like gonna blow anybody out of the gym. So I don't know where all this went, but let's just enjoy it while it lasts and understand that it's not over yet. It's just getting started. Also understand that if we lose Wednesday, there's going to be a real emergency pod, and I'm going to lose my fucking shit. So that's all I got tonight. I guess maybe I'll go to a mailbag. Otherwise, hope everybody's doing well.
See, it's time to pay dues, deliver the news. Like UMass, we refuse to lose. Rhymes and booze, the life we choose.
Okay, mailbag time. Mailbag brought to you by the fine folks at 5 College Movers. World-class, stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. Give Pat and the gang a call. Tell them we sent you. Friends of UMass Athletics, the UMass Basketball Podcast, and UMass Basketball. Now, by the way, the 5 College guys have been doing some great promos before the game, giving away some awesome merch based on contests and the like. So do follow 5 College Movers on Twitter if you don't already. Here's some questions. Tim Robertson, Hyperreal Tim, and I should note that a lot of these questions are things I cover. Some of them are things I cover, but I'm happy to double down here. He says, are fans overreacting to Game 2 in a weird year, and will we surprise parenthetical top 4 in conference play? So yes, they're overreacting, but it's a justifiable overreaction, if that makes sense, because the overreaction is a function of many years of frustration. And, you know, as I always say, fandom is not a rational enterprise. So you overreact because that's what it is. And the overreaction is obviously, or the reaction, I should say, is compounded and becomes an overreaction because of recent history and expectations around this team. So, yes, but that's not a bad thing. And will we surprise in conference play? And I just don't know anymore. I mean, I think after Friday, I was like, fuck yeah, we will. After today, I'm like, I don't know. Because I think some of it comes down to committing to how we want to play. I think there's a little bit of an identity crisis, particularly offensively, between the the structured approach of a McCall, which works at times, and the sheer talent of some of the personnel on this roster, and just letting them go. And that's a hard thing for a coach, but I just think you're going to have to pick one or the other, or you're going to have to heavily lean toward one or the other at a certain point. If you're going to want to make that surprise run. And it might not even be that surprising. I mean, the talent is there, 100%. Sitch, R. Sitchman, says, list two pleasant surprises and two unpleasant ones. I guess he means from the first two games. So the thing is, and not to toot my own horn here, I've been dead on with respect to, like, what I thought was going to happen with the freshmen. So I said Ronnie DeGray was going to be a consummate glue guy and be really helpful and start every game of his career, and I think that's bearing out or being borne out. And I said JG could be a certifiable star, but I still think it's a surprise because he's had in his first two games what I would expect, like, his best two games late in the year type games to be like. You know, I mean, over 50%, you know, 60, 70% from the field, over 50% today, over like 70% in game one, 23 points, 19 points. I mean, like, and he could have had more today. He didn't get any calls at the rim at all. He could easily had 25. So he's been even better, because I remember being like, well, you know, worst case scenario, if he isn't like a 9-4 guy or 9-3 guy, like, I'll be disappointed. He's like a 21-4 guy. Like, he's the best player on the floor, arguably. So that is somewhat of a surprise, I guess. And then the other surprise would be, I don't know, because, like, I think Noah is giving what I kind of hoped and expected he could give, but again, you know, I guess I had modest concerns because he just didn't put up any numbers really last year, and I knew the reasons for that. He was like six dudes on the roster ahead of him at the position, and terrible situation out there, and he got hurt before the season, so I knew he'd be good, but I guess it's a modest surprise. And then two unpleasant ones. So I guess modest, it's just hard. This would be a better question after five games, but such is this year where, you know, we're not going to get necessarily that many games. So I would say, you know, Matt's apparent unwillingness to give DeBaji extended minutes has been an unpleasant surprise. I don't know what the situation was with his health was Friday. I heard, you know, he may have been a little sick, non-COVID. But then he only played him 3 minutes today. And again, as I said in the intro, I get it, right? Like, if, you know, you're frustrated because he missed two shots or whatever. In like a crazy speed-up game when he was in there. I mean, it was like a mile a minute. And, you know, DeBaji, you know, he needs a little time to go to work. Like, you recall when he had 22 last year in one game and few other good games, like, he would, you know, work dudes in the lane. Like, he actually might benefit from a little slower of an offense in McCall's half-court game. Although, you know, I don't think he loves running a million screens. I think he just is he's a matchup guy. Like, again, it's a feel thing there. I think Matt is hyper-structured sometimes. So I think with a DeBaji, it's like, okay, he's 6'9", he's long as shit. Northeastern might not be a great matchup because they actually had a lot of length on that team. But there'd be games where it's like, okay, the team's playing three guards under 6'5", a 6'6 kid, and maybe one 6'10 dude. DeBaji, there's no logical matchup there for him. He's a guy who can go get buckets. So, you know, it's two games in, but he's a guy who can exploit matchups, and I'd like to see him play more. I'm not saying he's as good as I say he is. I get it. Like, it's, you know, people have called me out on it, and they're probably right to some extent. And defensively, he struggles, but, you know, I just think he can be a matchup nightmare. He can score in the mid-range in ways other guys can't. I actually think Kyrie McCrory is going to be like that, too. So that would be my second unpleasant surprise. He just hasn't gotten any run. Didn't play at all today. Played a little bit on Friday. And I just think, again, I don't think I'd care as much if Carl didn't get 30 minutes. Because it's just like, to me, 30 minutes or 29 minutes versus a combined three with McCrory, who is a good defender. We know that, regardless of if he can score yet. And who probably would have been an interesting matchup problem, because he's like 6'5 and he's strong. You know, for him and DiBiase to get a combined 3 minutes, you can't tell me Carl deserves to get 10 times the number of minutes as those two combined. I mean, I get it. Carl's a loyal soldier. He's been here forever. He's done some really great things. But you can't look at past performance. Just as I'm saying the fans probably are getting overreactive, like, Matt is overreacting to past performance. So I don't think he's as comfortable with DiBiase or he played a shortened season last year, and Cairo, who's like a unique player in terms of what he brings to the roster. Great wingspan, athletic, good defender, but like not a great shooter. He's just a unique player. I think Matt's maybe not yet comfortable as that. To some extent, DeAndre Dominguez too. You know, if you recall, I'm trying to think. Last year, to some extent with DiBiase, but certainly with Preston at the outset and a little bit with Colton, he wasn't fully comfortable with those guys either, and then they became really good down the stretch. So I don't know, you know, what that's all about, but I just think, like, maybe Matt has to get out of that that comfort space. And I know it's hard because Carl's been so loyal to him. And I don't mean to make this a knock on Carl. It's just when you have a deep roster and there's not a huge drop-off period one way or the other between, like, guys 3 to 9, then it's hard to justify one of them playing 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 times more than some of the others. That's a roundabout way of answering a question about surprises. Tavar Davis, T. Davis, 418, says, what's the rotation on this team? McCall and staff have had plenty of time to evaluate and know guys' strengths, etc., considering these are their guys. Enough with the everyone gets minute stuff. So I'm of two minds on this. I think you're right in that instinct, but I think that if they really are going to press, and I've actually been fairly pleased with the press, it leads to some easy buckets, but certainly on Friday it turned over Northeastern a ton, and it got UMass a ton of extra possession. So if you're going to play that way, you've kind of got to have a big rotation. But this notion, though, that everyone gets minutes, it's not really the case. I mean, DiBiase's played a total of 3 minutes. Cairo's probably played a total of 3-4 minutes. Didn't play today, played a little bit Friday. DeAndre, I guess he's played some, but that's two out of – so that's only 9 guys who are getting minutes. Mark Gasparini hasn't played much. So actually they've kind of been going – you know, today they had several guys play like 34 minutes. So I would actually dispute that and maybe say they should get more guys' minutes, and it should get maybe a little more balanced. So, you know, like instead of having whatever 4 or 5 guys play 29 plus, they should maybe spread them out a bit more. I'm looking at the box score. Yeah, like Ronnie, Trey, JG all played over 30, 32, 32, 34 respectively. Fernandez played 29. Pierre played 29. The only guy who got more than 10 off the bench was TJ. So, you know, Dominguez only played 8. You know, I mean, and again, like, he played 8 minutes. He got 2 boards, 0 for 3, all on 3s, none of which were bad attempts. And that's a little bit – and Walker got 2 shots, 1-3. Like, those guys got to get in a flow. Like, I mean, 8 minutes, okay, maybe you can say Dominguez, like, you know, showed enough in his 8 minutes. But – although I think he could have gotten 12, 14 and been fine. You can't say a guy gets 3 minutes, takes 2 not great shots, and that's it for the day. I just – in a pressing format, right? Like, Gasparini is what he is. You know, I think he'll figure it out. But – he's not going to be a 20-minute guy. And Colton, you know, he had 9 today. It is what it is. It's probably about standard. I'm looking at the box score from Friday. it was much more balanced. You're right. TJ came off the bench for 25 minutes. In that one, Colton played 15. DeAndre played 13. So in that one, there were, well, eight guys who played 13 minutes or more. But that's not a ton. And again, Pierre gets 28 in that one. So again, you spread just eight of those minutes around, right? And you give McCrory five more, so he's at seven, right? And you give, Fernandez had some foul trouble in that one, so that's why he played less. But yeah, I don't see that as like a primary concern yet. I mean, I do think there's a clear top five right now, and those guys should probably get the bulk of the minutes. And so basically that was today, but you just flip TJ and Carl. So instead of Carl getting 29, he gets like the 18 and TJ gets the 29. That would kind of be more my ideal. And then maybe spread around some minutes a little bit more to Cairo and Dabaji and Dominguez. Where those come from, I think, just depends on who's struggling on a given day. But like, if JG's going to work, you can't take him out. Like, he's that good. And Noah has moments where he's that good too. Michael Howell says, Bill Cohn was linked to the UMass job back in 2017. I think he's been linked to it a couple times, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, I guess not, because he's been at Northeastern 14 years, so he wouldn't probably have been linked to it when Kellogg got hired, because he would just been too early in his tenure. He says, what's UMass look like now with him going into year four? So yeah, I actually had an interesting tweet about this today, because, or self-proclaimed interesting tweet about this. I think Bill Cohn, I understand he's 60, and that's noteworthy, I think, because he's obviously incredibly content at Northeastern. He was a longtime assistant to Al Skinner. According to some people around basketball, they say that, you know, I think he and a couple others did the bulk of the work at BC. I mean, Ed Cooley was on that staff, of course, at Providence now, and I think there were some other, the UMass Lowell coach, Duquette, might have been on that staff at one point. So Skinner knew how to find, you know, the kind of younger guys who could do a lot of that stuff for him. So he's very good, very good. But I just don't know this. I don't know if he's interested. So certainly he's not interested in leaving now. I think it's pretty clear. Like, I've heard he makes really good money there. Somebody said $300,000, but somebody else said $600,000. And I think it's more like the latter. And the person who said the latter is someone who knows that program very well. So it may be public. I thought it would be private because it's a private school. So let's say he makes $600,000. Like, he's been there forever. Northeastern doesn't have, you know, an avid basketball fan base, and he goes to the tournament every 3-4 years or whatever. He's got a gig for life, you know, and all he's got to do is just, like, get that same type of kid, and he gets, like, their point guard could absolutely be really good in the A-10. And, you know, they get some guards who are going to fall through the cracks and, like, not go to an A-10 school and just be really good. Because, like, the CAA, the high-level CAA and the bottom-tier A-10 are, like, not that different, if at all. Like, I would argue that Northeastern would beat Fordham this year. And that's a young Northeastern team, but would beat Fordham, would probably beat LaSalle, you know, maybe beat GW based on how poorly they've been playing. I mean, they're a decent team. Like, that's what I'm trying to get at, why I'm not as freaked out about today. And Bill Cohn is a big reason why. They play discipline. They always play hard. He just gets kids to play hard. But that being said, that program, when you get to that point, like, it kind of just runs. It doesn't run itself. Nowhere runs itself. You got to work. But, you know, he knows what he wants. And I think to be really good in the A-10, like, to be a top four type team consistently, you just have to recruit at a pretty considerably higher clip. Like, the top tier A-10 teams in a good year would beat this Northeastern team 8.5 times out of 10, whereas UMass might beat them 6.3 times out of 10, 7, whatever. So, like, if he came, but so the question is he interested in recruiting at this level? And
when I say that, I mean it's I don't mean to suggest it's shady, but it's pretty cutthroat to get studs in the A-10. It's not as ruthless as the Power Fives in terms of just the underworld that you're dealing with. And I don't even mean like paying dudes or anything like that, although a number of places do that. I wish UMass were one of them sometimes. Under some previous administrations, that may have been the case, whatever. And that doesn't always work out either. But the point is, it's just a shadier underbelly, right, to get dudes. And not, I don't just mean shady like money, right? It's like you're just dealing with kids have more handlers. Kids have more – just there's more people in their corner who are making the process more difficult and less straightforward than it you know, probably needs to be in many ways, because you're dealing with, you know – money in the future, right? Like it's these kids are gonna, many of them are going to go pro or even high level Europe. So Northeastern, I just think he can just go out, make his pitch. Like one of the kids today was from London. You know, it's a little bit of a different game. It's a little bit like not unlike Davidson or certain A-10 programs, but those programs will get like one or two kids who are studs, right? And then they can recruit the rest. Like Davidson is basically there's always like a Kellen Grady or they have a star. And then, like, four awesome foreign players, and then a few guys who easily could have gone to Northeastern, probably were recruited at Northeastern. So, I don't know what I'm getting at. It's a roundabout way of saying, I don't know if Bill Cohn, at this point, if he came here at 57, would be interested in, like, working the AAU circuit so relentlessly all summer to try to get one kid and, you know, leveraging every relationship he's ever had to, you know, I just don't know. And I think, like, my sense from afar is that the guy at George Mason, Dave Paulson, has struggled in the same way. He's a really good coach. I used to watch him at Williams College when they played Amherst College in the early 2000s. And he was a fantastic coach, played at Williams. And then he went from there to Bucknell, you know, high-level Patriot League, dominated there because it's the Patriot League, right? You just get the better kids who are going to go to Williams, but, you know, we're going to be the ninth man at Colgate, but they went to Williams to be an All-American. Like, you just get the next tier up of that kid, the kid who was going to go to the CAA and whatever. It's just a different game. It's an academic school. You know what you're getting. When he went to the A-10, like, he is a good coach. They run good stuff. They're structured. They play together. And they win some games, but they just never quite have, like, that dude, right? And, like, UMass, you're seeing the difference when you get a Trey Mitchell and a Jamon Garcia, like what you saw on Friday. When you get a couple dudes, it's just, like, it doesn't matter. You're going to win some games just by virtue of having those dudes. And, like, that's, I think, difficult for people to understand from afar because there are always going to be instances where the Dave Paulsons and the Bill Cohns of the world are going to win a bunch of games and beat better teams, you know, athletically better teams. So there's always that temptation to be like, oh, like, we should just get that guy because, you know, he runs a clean program and he went whatever. And it's true to a point, but when it comes right down to it, it's like, I feel like George Mason never has finished over 8th. 9th, whatever. So, you know, I mean, they never finished like beyond. I mean, they probably had a couple, you know, 5 or 6 seeds maybe, but they never are like a team in Brooklyn that you're like, oh, fuck, I hope we don't run into them. You know, they just don't have, and like Otis Livingston was really good. They've had guys, like they get players. I'm not saying, but they just always feel like a glorified Northeastern rather than in that, like Dayton, St. Louis, VCU. These teams spend a fuck ton of money on basketball. They care. Occasionally, St. Joe's, like, we'll do that. You know, they get, like, a Bembry or, I mean, like, these are programs that have histories and are reputable and send guys to the NBA. So it's just a different tier, and I don't know if he's into that. But to answer the question, I think they would be certainly better than what Matt did in his first 2 years. And probably better than last year because he would have built continuity and he probably would have seen fewer kids transfer out. I think a longtime head coach just understands. I think it takes a while. I mean, he's doing it 14 years and he was at BC as a longtime assistant. I think it takes a while to figure out and get a precise read. I'd like to talk to coaches about this, actually, because I'm kind of coming out of my ass with this. But it takes a long time, I think, to get a precise read on what type of kids fit you. Matt has gotten better, but especially when he first came here, he was out of region. He didn't have trusted sources in the region. He didn't totally know, and he got hired late because the Pat Kelsey fiasco. So I just think Bill Cohn knows exactly what kind of kid he wants, and he knows exactly what it takes to win at a certain level. And so even if he was uncomfortable going into the underworld, he'd have enough kids who were seniors now that they would be 100% competing for the fourth or fifth spot. The question, and probably would have been close last year, the question is, would they ever be close to competing for the second, third, or first, second, or third spot? And that's what I'm more, I think much the way Dave Paulson is like that at George Mason, I think Cohn would be a slightly better version because Northeastern is a better version of Bucknell, and so he'd kind of know, and he's in region. So I think he'd get some dudes for sure, but I don't know if he'd be competing with. Yeah, this year they'd actually be good because I think St. Louis is loaded athletically, but they're not well coached, and Richmond is I think they could be similar to Richmond, this year's Richmond team. That would be, but probably a little worse because this Richmond team happens to be very good. But that would be the ceiling. The problem with that Richmond team again though is once all those kids leave, you don't reload there. It takes a few years to reload. They're not good enough to be a every year type of team because it's just they're not built that way for a variety of reasons. Good question. Kind of went on too long on that. Sitcha has another question. He says, will Tony B take over this program when? All right. So I feel like this one is just one of those questions that percolates, and how could it not? 8 of the dudes played at the high school he coached at or were going there. And he even recruited Colton Mitchell, if I'm not mistaken. So that makes 9 of the 11 plus Preston if you were to return. So basically 10 of 12 are Bergeron's players. 8 of which played directly under him, because Garcia was going to play under him until he came to UMass, is my understanding. And I think he had a tie to Colton somehow. So basically Gasparini and Pierre are the only dudes who are not Tony's dudes. So it's a reasonable question. It's one of those ones I don't love to discuss because I don't want to sow any – I don't want to foment any rumor mongering or whatever. But, if you bring 10 kids here, it's a logical question. So let's discuss it. And I think we've discussed it a little bit before on the show, but here's the reality. Whatever you think, whether you think Tony is, the greatest thing that ever happened to UMass or an asshole, it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters in terms of his future at UMass is whether they win while he's an assistant, because he is an assistant. So the nature of – now, you can get into all sorts of hypotheticals. If Tony had this team on his own and if Tony was coaching at another school, and would they be – I actually happen to think Tony would be a very good head coach. I think he proved it at the prep level. I think in much the way that Danny Hurley did, another guy who is not always beloved by everyone around the game, but, then did 2 years at Wagner, and then, boom, he's at URI, right? I have no doubt that, in fact, several prep coaches around the country would make very good Division I head coaches, including Tony Bergeron, very quickly once they migrate to that position. However, Number one, there's a lot to that job that has nothing to do with the basketball court. And that it's an administrative role. It is a fundraising role. It is a cover your ass role. Make sure that fucking, you know, the buck stops there, right? And so I think a lot of great prep coaches, Tony included, are outstanding on the basketball side, outstanding on the recruiting side, X and O, no doubt, 100%. What they just haven't done, and this isn't to say they couldn't do it, but what they haven't done or what they haven't been groomed to do is to deal with the media, to deal with booster club outings, to deal with managing the, you know, personality of college, you know, and the prickly nature of collegiate administrators and college presidents and self-important deans and fucking trustees and just all that shit. Basketball teams at Division I universities are big business. They're high profile. There's a whole nother layer of sort of like almost M as in man, not N as in NBA, but MBA speak. And, you know, the public relations side, and there's a lot to it that's not inside the lines, if you will. So, all that being said, and by the way, Tony might be terrific at all those things, and as my other prep coaches, I'm just saying that the sort of like, if he was head coach, would these things be different? I don't know, because that we only know about him between lines. I think he's very good. Terrific, in fact. I think he's, and I could get into that at great length. I like Tony a lot. So, but here's the bottom line. He's not getting a crack at this program. He's not getting even a smidgen of an iota of a shot unless they're very successful while he is an assistant. So, the soonest he could take it over is if they had a phenomenal year this year and Matt got poached by another program, probably one down south where he's from and I think really likes. Conversely, and then Tony, you know, then you'd have, then I will say right now, I would make a case for him. We'd have to see what other candidates are out there, but like a guy who brought in 10 dudes and they improved, you know, a fuck ton in those 2 years. Like that seems, you know, you got to check all the other boxes, but like seems like a good hire to me. But the second option would be they win enough this year. Matt and the staff are extended so that, you know, in their contract, so that everybody feels comfortable returning. And and then they win a fuck ton next year, or at least the year after that, because they've been extended and they're still here. And then Matt leaves and gets another job. So, like, obviously, the bottom line is, it's a roundabout way of saying they have to win a bunch more with him as an assistant before he's in conversation for, because you can bring 10 guys here if you guys lose. Even if you would have won with you as the head coach, it doesn't matter. Like, you're still an assistant on the staff that didn't win, and therefore they're not going to elevate someone who is part of a losing staff. There's probably a case in, like, a scenario in which, like, that would actually make good sense, but no athletic director would ever do that. They would be perceiving themselves to be committing career suicide, or because if Jim Cruz at St. Louis was Rick Majerus's longtime assistant, and he got the job when Rick died, if I recall. I forget exactly how it played out, and he was a horrendous coach right away. Like, or no, I think he might have had one good year because he had like all Rick's dudes, and then he was like awful, and you just knew he was gone. But he only got the job because he inherited a great group that he had been with that had won. They wouldn't have given it to him if Majerus's last teams were like 14 and 17. It's just not, I mean, it's just hard sell to make in the public eye. And, you know, I think because coaching searches, you got to remember, like, that's when everybody tunes in. People are like, all right, let's like get this right. You know, and like a lot of casuals are tuning in. And if you see a thing go off the rails and you don't want anyone who's been a part of it to get the reins. Now, more likely, if Matt were to have a disastrous year this year, the logical choice would be you hire someone and you make sure that they retain Tony. But then you don't know, like, does Tony want to be with that guy? You know, because if you don't, some of the guys who came here who are very loyal to Tony and played for him at prep wouldn't want to stay. I mean, like, you know, a lot of guys come to – it's very common for guys to the primary recruiter to be, you know, a major reason why they committed to a school. And if that person's gone and you felt very loyal to them, you spent, you know, countless hours a week with them or whatever, makes sense for you to abandon ship. So you have to be very mindful of that, which is why we don't want to think about those things. We want to win right now, and then we can have a wonderful off-season conversation about whether Tony Bergeron is the right man to take the reins of the program. And I would love to have that conversation and probably vouch for him if they go out and get 20 wins or whatever. And or, you know, I mean, this season we only get 20 games, so I'm not sure. But you get what I'm saying. So, Luftig, Cheming in PA. C-H-E-M. Oh, I get it. It's Chem Engine, as in chemical engineer, Pennsylvania. I can't believe I just figured that out. See, I've told you I don't have any skills in the STEM field, so that's why I didn't make the connection until now. He says, why is TJ Weeks coming off the bench? He was key part of team chemistry to start last season, IMO. Worked in some social chemistry into your chemical engineering chemistry. Gosh, chemical engineering. If you could give me I had some friends who were chemies in college. I don't know what they did. Like, that is so foreign to me. Like, what do they do all day in the labs and shit? Could you tell me? I would actually love to know. Like, what is your day-to-day like, and what mathematics are you using frequently? Because I didn't really go much beyond, like, pre-calculus. So I really want to know, like, what your day-to-day was like. Okay, why is TJ Weeks coming off the bench? He was a key part of team chemistry to start last season. I discussed this half the show. Yeah, I mean, start him. No, I don't know. I mean, I think Matt's loyal to Carl, and now TJ is showing that he's played better. And if TJ breaks a bunch of shots, then start Carl again. Make it a competition. I'm fine with that. Jake Barnes, what's the ideal pace you would like UMass to play at? Felt like it was either too fast or too slow at times today. Yeah, that's spot on, man. So I think I was saying at one point, like, play really fast, go, go, go. And I do mean that to an extent, but it was too fast in the early going today. I mean, it was out of control. Like, it looked like I was watching sprints, you know, people just racing back and down. And I frankly, we probably could have won that way. Both teams would have been worn out. We probably would have won. But the answer is, it's like, I want to play at a controlled attacking pace, and I don't want to get bogged down in half-court sets that don't really go anywhere. So there are instances where I think Matt runs some phenomenal actions where, like, there was that play with Ronnie DeGray where he just, like, slipped the screen and just got open so easily. There are certain things where, you know, those kind of, like, I was talking about it with someone tonight who's a listener of the show. Shout out to Son of Large Mark. And he was making a really good point about it, which was, like, when they do that kind of, like, dribble weave motion thing at the top of the key, and then kind of bring a guy up to the block, and he kind of, like, sometimes they, I don't know how they do it because I don't know enough about offense. That's why I would like to have Matt on, but again, to talk about just that. But some of those work brilliantly. There's a few each game where you're like, damn, like, that was gorgeous. And I really do think Matt's gifted in that regard. But the thing is, they only had 8 assists today, right? And so it's like, it's obviously not working that well. And you have Javon Garcia now. So, like, when I say controlled attacking, I mean, he's a matchup problem, period. So let him exploit that. If they double him, he's going to find a guy. So, you know, work on, I guess, opponent-specific matchup challenges and attack those. And you could still have some of those great little one-hitter plays. I'm all for it.
But if you're only getting 8 assists on 75 points, then obviously that offense isn't dynamic enough. And to make it more dynamic, I think my sense is requires a tremendous amount of discipline, patience, and time with respect to the implementation of it. Which, okay, that's cool if you're Davidson, I think, who has not as many athletes as we do. And so they have to rely a little bit more on some of those things to get all these open looks and all these creative reads that lead to, you know, open threes. I don't think UMass right now has to do that. I think they have the luxury of having like a potentially all-league point guard and the best big in the league to play a little two-man game. You know, it's a little more complicated than I'm saying, and I appreciate that, like, I don't spend my days around basketball, but play a little two-man game, a little pick-and-roll action, have TJ sitting in the corner, you know, have Noah sitting in the other corner, right? Have, you know, Ronnie crashing the boards and, like, go, you know? I mean, like, so I understand Matt's impulse, I think, to create easy buckets out of half-court offense, and he does talk a lot about, talked about after the game today, like, the analytics of when you pass the ball more than three times, and I'm okay with that. I think he's probably right, but do the passes have to come in the confines of one of 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or however many plays he has in his playbook? And I told you the first time I ever met Matt, he boasted about the size of his playbook, which I liked. And I really liked when he had not a very impressive roster that first year, I think. Although they didn't run a ton that first year, but the point is, like, I appreciated it from a basketball mind perspective, especially considering that his predecessor, I don't think, ran a play in his life. But at the same time, it's like, listen, dude, you got JG. Let him go. Like, fucking, like, he's a special player. He is a special player. Guys, like, I don't want to sound like, you know, listen, guys, like, I know. But, like, he's a special player. And Trey's a special player. You got two dudes, and you got some shooters around him. Noah plays hard and shoots it. TJ can shoot the shit out of it. Yeah, he could work on his D. You know, there's things here and there, but when you got two guys like that, like, we run so many sets, I feel like, that end up in the hands of anyone, you know? And it's just like, get those two dudes involved, and, like, you know, obviously you have to run some plays to get Trey open, but I think the tempo should be fast and purposeful in the half court. Right, so, like, if JG drives and misses a shot, like today he missed a couple layups. I thought he got hacked. He missed them. I didn't care. It's like, even he made a couple turnovers. Like, I don't care. He's attacking, you know? And it wasn't Chaz attacking either, where Chaz would, like, run into four dudes like a pinball machine and then, you know, sometimes have a 35-point game. I mean, Chaz is great, don't get me wrong, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I really think the sky's the limit for JG. Like, I think he's that good. I think these two games were, every time he had the ball in his hands, you just felt comfortable. You were like, all right, he's not going to, like, do some dumb shit. Chaz would do some sensational shit. But he'd also be like, oh, yeah, he's 5'5", and he just, like, ran into a dude's ass, like, butt fumble style. You know, it just, and I love Chaz. Like, I don't mean to knock him, but I just think JG sees the whole floor. He's, like, 6'3". He can defend. I mean, play at whatever pace he and Trey can, like, go to work, and then these other guys can have really important roles hitting open shots. So, yeah. Alcides Coop on Alcides _ Coop says, can we look forward to a Sage revenge tour / I told you so about Javon Garcia? Yeah, I've kind of already been doing that. And, like, I'm sure he'll have a game with 6 points and 7 turnovers, and some asshole will be like, no, he's not as good as you said, man. And, like, whatever. Sky's the limit. I'm not going to go on a victory tour. I just want the kid to dominate games and play in an offense that suits him the most. Because
He and Trey are guys you can just build everything around. Like, those are stars. They are legitimate stars. And it would be, I know he's a freshman, I don't care. I mean, he's putting up 20 plus in the first two games. Like, I know it's two games, but he did it on 13 shots the first game, 9 shots today. Like, he's not even scratching the surface of how good he can be. Like, you can put the ball in his hands and let him get to the... He's been deadly from three, which was the one area of his game I thought he wasn't good at. I mean, like... So I'm not going to go on a victory tour, but I'm just going to appreciate it because he's that good. McKinney, StatsMass. McCall talked about reallocating minutes after the game. Are the minutes too pre-allocated? Very McKinney question. There have been a few times where UMass has come out with great plays after timeouts under McCall. But will in-game adjustments bottleneck this team? So let's go part by part there. Reallocating minutes. Are the minutes too pre-allocated? I don't think they're too pre-allocated yet. Because we talked about it earlier, but if you looked at the minutes in game one versus game two, they varied. And I think it's perfectly normal for any coach over the first... It's one of the shitty parts about having so little of a non-conference is you can't really figure out that rotation because you just don't have much time. We start conference play on Wednesday. Like, that's it. You know, there's no... So, I mean, to some extent, like, you have to figure out allocation based on performance. And now you have a sample size of 2, and that's not ideal. You want a sample size of 8, 9, 10, 11. But it is what it is, as they say. And, excuse me, I'm trying to find the question here because I don't know if I got to all of it. But I don't think they're too pre-allocated yet, no. Frankly, you could argue that they should be a little bit more pre-allocated. Because you kind of know at this point, like, what TJ can do from those games last year and from the last two games. So at this point, it's like, to me, there's a clear-cut starting five. I didn't know it would come that early, and maybe it will change, because I do think Cairo McCrory, DeAndre Dominguez, are very high-ceiling guys, and even though we've seen very little of them yet, like, they have high ceilings, so they will force their way into the conversation in the same way Preston did last year. I don't think it's too pre-allocated. But he says, there have been a few times when UMass has come out with great plays after timeouts. Yes, I agree. And then he says, well, in-game adjustments bottleneck this team. If you mean in-game adjustments like poor substitution patterns, yes. I thought Matt's biggest issue today was his subbing. It's just like, I don't know. I'm watching the game, and that's a feel thing, you know? I mean, it really is. I'm sure there's a science to it to an extent, but there's so many variation permutations and things like that it's hard to quantify, like, precisely what works. So it is, at the end of the day, kind of a feel thing, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. Analytics people, feel free to correct me. But in real time, when you're making those decisions, like, you know, you can rely on data, but, like, it's just new. It's like, TJ should be in there, you know? Like, it's, come on, you know? Like, so, that could bottleneck them, yes. I mean, yes. Like, if you continue to, and I guess that is related to your first question, if you continue to misallocate minutes, that is a form of bad in-game adjustments. Because it means you're not pulling guys at the appropriate time. And, you know, yeah, so it could bottleneck this team, yes. I hope it doesn't. A Dayton fan who I like, good follow, Ghost McHistory, he says, how far can the team go without Trey? Like, this exact group without Trey Mitchell, it'd be so different. Wow, it'd be so interesting, actually, to see how they even played. Because, like, I actually do think Mark Gasparini is much better than he's played. I just think it's like he's not used to playing 5 or 6 minutes. So it's weird. I think he started for, like, the better part of 3 years at American. So, and you can just see he's the kind of dude who gets, like, a little Luke Bonner energy there, you know? Like, he's the kind of dude who just kind of, like,
you can just tell he's waiting to set up and you know, back a dude in and kind of get some touches and gradually get in the flow of the game. And then it's like, nah, you're out. Trey's going back in. So, you know, I think he'd probably play a lot more and he'd be like a respectable, you know, A-10 center, but you couldn't really run an offense around him. So I think you'd probably run everything around JG, and then you'd probably surround him with like both Carl and TJ, and you know, you'd probably have Ronnie at the four. Like, you wouldn't be terrible. Be better than some UMass teams of the past, but you sure wouldn't be very good. I mean, be lucky to get a 500 season. But that's like kind of saying like, you know, who is Dayton without Obi Toppin this year? They're just not the same team. They're winning some games. They also lost some games. And, you know, like, you're probably better than UMass would be without Trey, but, I mean, just, you take the best player of a generation, and it's like, obviously, it's a totally different dynamic. Is that it? Let's see if I got any more. Never Stop Recruiting says, I think he's talking about something else. He says, unless Jimerson, who's at St. Louis, and TJ Weeks are given consideration since they're redshirt freshmen, does Garcia have any likely competition for that award? Presumably he means A-10 Rookie of the Year. I honestly just don't know all of the A-10 yet. So I'm not sure who the other great freshmen around the league are, but I do have a hard time imagining there's someone as talented as him right now. I mean, especially in a league that brings back so much, where a lot of teams' starting fives are kind of predetermined. So that's all I got. As A. Kalegi, Andrew Kalegi, former host of this program, would say, we love you, we out, and go UMass.